In a moment, we're going to be thinking particularly about the second half of Luke chapter 15. We've heard the first half read already, but Imogen is going to come and read the second half for us.
Jesus continued. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his fingers and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the elder son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The elder brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Let's pray. Father in heaven, as we come to this, for many of us, very familiar part of your word, this famous story that Jesus told. Please strike us anew with its wonder that this brother was lost and is found, that you are the God who shows this love, and that you show it to us as we come to you. Amen. It's interesting if you observe our society that even with all of the division and other things that people might point out, our society often seems to think of itself as quite a forgiving society on the whole. It seems that people in the normal course of things, in the normal course of life, think, yeah, we're pretty forgiving individually, as groups, and then as a society, we can be pretty forgiving. We bear with one another. And as people, I've read a number of kind of editorials and things like that this week, particularly searching for the idea of forgiveness in kind of the news and that sort of thing. And it's amazing how many times people keep on going, we just need to get back to our kind of the forgiving nature that just seems to come so naturally to our society. That's the big thing that we seem to be moving away from. And our society has always been forgiving. But has it really? Is it really like that? When you really drill down into our society and you think about it, is there really evidence that we are a forgiving society? Maybe, perhaps, in many things there might be, except in some particular areas, right? In some particular areas, this is maybe not quite so the case. 13th of August, 2017, the World Championship Athletics competition was coming to its kind of climax, the final of the 100 metres. And particularly that day, it was a particularly amazing climax because it was Usain Bolt's final individual 100 metre race. It was the greatest sprinter of all time about to bow out with a kind of in a blaze of world championship glory. That was what was expected. The stage was set. And the stage was also set for the pantomime villain of all pantomime villains as far as athletics goes, because lining up two lanes away from Usain Bolt was Justin Gatlin. Justin Gatlin was a 100-meter sprinter who had been banned twice for taking banned substances, for having positive blood tests for drug abuse in his system. He'd been banned twice, he'd been allowed to race again, he had got to the final of the World Championships. And as the crowd kind of milled around and watched and the build-up happened, nobody thought that the unthinkable could happen. Everybody thought, surely, you know, Bolt has this in the bag. The starter pistol went off. Bolt got a bad start. Gatlin got an excellent start. The guy in between them, an even better start, and Gatlin managed to hang on his shoulder and power through to win the World Championship final. The drug abuser had vanquished the hero. This wasn't how it was supposed to end. And I don't want to make any comments about the rights or wrongs of the IAAF, the International Athletics Federation, and whether or not they should have allowed Justin Gatlin to race, but it was very interesting to see the response in the kind of media in the following days. This is what was written in the Telegraph, in the sports section. You may never see a greater anti-climax. In this one, the world champion was jeered, while the darling of the global crowd for 9 years was acclaimed as the hero. And get this, frankly, it was a woeful result for track and field, only allowed by a wrong culture of forgiveness. What a phrase. As I say, I don't want to make any comments on the rights or wrongs of whether Gatlin should have been there. You can ask me what I think afterwards. But what a phrase to say. The only reason that this could possibly have been allowed was because of a wrong culture of forgiveness. And we see this sort of thing perhaps played out again and again as, you know, historic social media kind of comments that were injudicious and sometimes downright immoral are dug up against people. And the question I sometimes want to ask is forgiveness actually possible for something which someone has done in the past or said in the past? And if so, what does it look like in society? Because actually we know that forgiveness is required all the time, don't we? In our day-to-day life, with our family and with our friends, with our work colleagues, with our church family, we know that as we bundle on through these kind of relationships that make up our life, we bump into one another, we make mistakes. Sometimes we do things wrong, not because of their mistakes, but actually because we wanted to hurt someone. We've lashed out. We need to seek people's forgiveness, and we need to receive people's forgiveness, and we need to forgive others. And yet we live in this tension, don't we, between this right desire for justice when things are wrong, and yet this also knowledge that we need forgiveness if life is going to work, but perhaps for reasons even more deeply than that. So I want to ask, how are you responding this evening to the parable of the lost son, as it's called in our Bibles? How are you responding as Jesus tells this story of, well, outrageous forgiveness? It's one of the most famous parables that Jesus ever told. Probably one of the most well-known stories that Jesus ever told. There will be people who aren't churchgoers who, if you ask them to name a story that Jesus told, they might go for the lost son and the good Samaritan. These are the things that people know. This is something people know. But if we want to understand this story well, we need to know who Jesus is telling it to and why. So have a look with me at the beginning of chapter 15. Tom read it earlier, 15, verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So as we hear Jesus telling this story, we need to visualize him with two groups of people. One group is really close to him, the tax collectors and the sinners. They are gathering round him. They're hanging on his every word. They're being welcomed by Jesus. And the question is, well, who are they? Well, they are the notorious bad guys. In that society, they are the ones who are known for their wickedness. Now, in the first century, well, in fact, for a number of centuries around time, obviously Rome ruled supreme. And they had a massive empire, when you think about it, from North Africa to kind of North England, and who knows how wide, an enormous empire. But here's the thing, if you have an enormous empire like that, and your pre-days, you know, of, I don't know, airstrikes and tanks and stuff like that, how do you control rebels in your empire? Answer, you have a massive army, absolutely enormous army. And how do you fund an enormous army? Taxes. You get taxes from as much of your empire as you possibly can so that you can fund the army. But here's the thing. When the army went conquering new regions, they were not like Russell Crowe in Gladiator. They were brutal. Brutal people. The Roman army, it is on record, the Roman army once crucified 20,000 people from one city in one go. Men, women, and children on either side of the road, 10,000 people on either side of the road running up to a city that had rebelled against Rome. For miles, you'd be walking along this road with that message, don't mess with Rome. And so people, as the Roman Empire conquered regions, people would kind of sell out. Rather than to get that treatment, they would join the Roman army and go off and, I guess, deal it out elsewhere. But then to fund that army, there would be more people who would sell out to the Roman army, sometimes even pay for the privilege of receiving taxes from their own people to fund the army that's dealing out that kind of treatment. So when you think tax collector in the New Testament, don't just think inland revenue, bit of a bind. Think people who are wandering around in society getting rich off the legal murder of your family members. That is how people viewed the tax collectors. These guys are like scum. Lowest of the low. And Jesus is welcoming them. And then standing at a distance, you get the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. You know, the uber religious guys. The guys with 9 or 10 fish on the back of their chariots or whatever it was they were driving around. The guys who do everything right. They are really good at being good. And they know that they are right with God by their goodness. And they know that those tax collectors and other sinners are not. And they would tell those tax collectors and sinners regularly. So little wonder is it that these guys who know they're the good guys, who know they're right with God, are looking at Jesus and going, he's welcoming those guys? And Luke 15 is Jesus' response to that muttering. First, he tells two stories about lost things, a lost sheep and a lost coin. And the point is, rejoice. Verse 6, rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep. Verse 9, rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin. And what's the point? Jesus is saying, these guys who you're saying are completely lost, completely out of any hope with relationship with God, when you know that you are absolutely right, let me tell you, God rejoices when lost people like that come home. Imagine the muttering, growing in volume. Imagine the faces of the Pharisees as they begin to hear Jesus telling these two stories, going, sorry, what? At the same time, imagine the tax collectors and the sinners always told that they could never be right with God the way that they are. They are too bad. Hearing this story, really? Could it be? God rejoices when lost people come home. And then to drive his point home, Jesus tells another story. Verse 11, Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. Which actually means, when you think about it, that our title that's in our Bibles, the parable of the lost son, remember those were not in the original text of the Bible, they've been put there to help us a lot of the time. The parable of the lost son isn't actually a great title, is it? Because Jesus is telling a story about a man who had two sons, a man, a father, and two sons. That's Jesus' title for this. And as he tells this story, he is going to drive his point home that God's love extends to those people that he is talking to. God's outrageous love extends to rebellious and respectable rejection. That is going to be Jesus' big point. And we're going to see this in four chunks as we work through this story. So here's the first thing. The first thing we see is rebellious rejection. So Jesus carries on. Verse 12, the younger son, the younger one, said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. So Jesus said, one day, the younger son of the two sons of this man comes to his father and says, well, he basically says, Dad, why don't you just die? Why don't you just die? I know that the stuff that you own is all really great, and I know that when you die, I'm going to be entitled to a share of it, but to be honest, I want that day to come now. I'd like to get my share of the property now, thank you very much. You know, the stuff that you have is all brilliant. It's wonderful, but I just don't really like you hanging around spoiling my chance to enjoy it. That's the attitude of this younger son. I wonder, what would you have done if you were a father or a mother in that situation? What would you have done? Put the son in their place? What do you think you're saying? How dare you say something like that? That isn't what this father does. This father divided his property between them. And actually, don't miss this. The word his property literally means the life. This father divides, it's almost like his life, his livelihood, everything that he is, he divides between his sons at this request. Why would a father do that? The father would do that if he's a father who doesn't want a begrudging servant waiting until he dies in place of a son. So he lets him go. Not a begrudging servant, and neither a loving son. And so off goes the son, verse 13. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. So off goes the son with all of this kind of newfound wealth. A share of his father's property, he sells it, he takes all the money, off he goes, and it is brilliant for a while. He's free. There are no restraints. He can enjoy himself. His dad isn't around spoiling his fun anymore. He can get on and do whatever he likes. But it isn't long before the dream turns into a nightmare. Now, don't miss this. Remember who the audience that Jesus is talking to. Tax collectors and Pharisees, all of them are Jewish. What is the one animal, well, number of animals, but the one animal Jews are particularly famous for not eating, not touching, because it is unclean? Pigs. And here is this young Jewish boy who has now had to hire himself out to someone in, we must say, a non-Jewish country who is keeping pigs so that he himself can look after the pigs. For a Jew, this is the worst job imaginable. This young lad could not get any lower. This is filthy. There's nothing, nowhere down for him to go from here. And the point is that in this story, as Jesus tells it, where the father represents God, the sons, they represent us. And so as Jesus tells the story of the younger son, he is describing the human relationship with God. God has given us so much wonderful stuff, so much wonderful things. We were thinking about that a little bit this morning, in the thankfulness that we should have for these things as they lead us to God, family and friends and career and money and sex and on and on and on, wonderful goods given in creation. And we would take them, but we don't want a divine parent telling us how to use them or live with them. We want to get on and do what we think is best, thank you very much. But the point of the story is that life without God, life turning away from God like that, it doesn't go well. And it will end up in the pigsty in the end. Because when you think about it, God is the one who made life. He's the one who designed all of those things. He's the one who knows how life works best. He is the source of life. And we go, well, we're going to have great fun with your gifts and we'll be better off without you. But the whole point is we're turning our back on the one who knows how it all works. And none of it works right without him. When I was in Newcastle as a student at my church, I remember hearing a testimony of a fellow student who'd come up to Newcastle from a Christian family, but not really too sure what she believed herself. And she kind of bundled along through university for a little bit. She ended up getting involved with a guy and sleeping with him for the first 2 years of university. And she thought life was great. And then she ended up coming along to church in Newcastle. I don't know what it was that prompted her to come along, but she came back to the Lord. And a few months after that, she was interviewed, and she said this. She said, you know, all that time with the boy, I felt dirty and used, but I was too frightened to say anything. Because, of course, the official line was, we're all having fun. The official line was, we're all having fun. Sure, it might feel like freedom to begin with, all of that life, all of that stuff with no restraints, but in the end, life without God is no life at all. And it will wind us up in trouble, whether that's here, like the younger son experiences, or like that student my friend experienced, or worse, as our God allows us to keep on rejecting him until we find ourselves rejecting him forever. And we end up in the pigsty that the Bible describes as hell. That is the position of the younger son, and that is the position of each of us in relationship to God as we take the good things he gives us and ignore him. But that's not the end of the story. Because the younger son comes to his senses. Verse 17, when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So there's the younger son at rock bottom in the fields feeding pigs, but no one's giving him anything. He's even longing to eat the pig food. And then it's like he wakes up. He looks in a mirror. He's like, "How on earth did you get here? What has happened?" He pinches himself. And then he does three things. First, he remembers his father's goodness. His father is a good man who looks after his servants well. "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here am I, starving to death." His father looks after his servants well. He's definitely a whole lot better than this loser of a boss that this son must be working for, feeding pigs but starving to death himself. And having remembered his father's goodness, he then recognizes, second thing, his own wrongdoing. "I have sinned against heaven and against you." And the point is, he's right, isn't he? He has essentially spat in his father's face, taken his stuff and left it, wished his father dead. And then, having remembered his father's goodness, recognized his own wrongdoing, verse 20, he got up and went to his father. The third thing, he returns to his father. And notice, he doesn't expect much, does he? He expects to be made a household servant, which actually in the day is even lower than a household slave. Let me explain why. The household slave was part of the household, was looked after from the master's table, would receive food, and where a good master, as we can expect that this father was actually looked after very well often. A household servant was the kind of day laborer who would come on a 0 hours contract that lasts for just a day and then hope to get another contract the next day and another one the next day. These guys were living literally hand to mouth. They were the lowest of the workers. And that is what this son expects that he might just manage to be able to be when he gets back to his father. So let's pause the story, hit pause for a second on the story. Because remember Jesus' audience as he tells this story. There are two groups. There are the tax collectors and the sinners gathering around him. And there are the Pharisees standing at a distance muttering. What are they doing? How are they reacting right now as Jesus tells this story when he gets to this point? You can imagine the tax collectors and the sinners who've been drawn in by these stories of the lost sheep and the lost coin go, "Ah, so here's the catch. Here's the point. This son, all of that stuff about kind of lost things being found, here's the catch, because here's this son is going to go home and he is going to have to work to get anywhere near his father's favor. That is what must be going to happen." And the Pharisees, well, they're going, "Sorry, who does he think he is? Who does this son have? What on earth is he doing going back to his father? After all that he's done, ended up in the pigsty, serves him right. I hope that his father gives him a good dose of paternal discipline, gives him a kicking right back to the pigsty like he deserves." And then Jesus throws in the twist. And this is the second thing, the outrageous love for rebellious rejection. Have a look at the verse 20. "He got up and went to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." So imagine as the son kind of shuffles his way home, sort of reluctantly, but knowing that there's nowhere else from really to go, he makes his way home. I guess his head is bowed and he's kind of practicing his I'm sorry speech, isn't he? Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. He's practicing over and over and over again. He barely dare to lift his head up to look towards home. And then he glances up to the horizon and he sees a figure running. Which means that his dad must have been out on the end of the driveway with binoculars in hands every day, scouring the horizon looking for his son to come home. He must have been on his phone constantly, checking for answer phone messages, checking for that familiar voice, looking on WhatsApp, trying to see on Facebook Messenger, is he sending anything? What sort of contact has he had with him? Probably nothing, for who knows how long. And now, he looks up and he sees that familiar walk. He'd know that walk anywhere. That's his son coming over the horizon, and he runs. And then verse 21, the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. He starts this carefully prepared speech, right? But did you notice the father doesn't even let him finish it? Doesn't even let him finish it. Just not even, yeah, you're right, that was dumb. Get the cow. He just says, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Not even a mention of what his son has done. You're not my servant. You're my son. And you're home. And so the father restores his son. And don't miss how much this would have cost the father. You can imagine the neighbors kind of muttering, I mean, have you heard? Johnny's come home. After all of that. You know, he went off, he took his share, went off. Who knows what he's been doing these last few years. And now he's come home and you'll never guess. He's just been accepted straight back into the family. After all that. I mean, doesn't any of it matter? And the answer, of course, is yes. Yes, it does matter. But the father is willing to absorb the cost of forgiveness. And if the son is us as towards God, well, the father is God towards us. As we've spat in his face, taken his gifts, and rejected him, we deserve nothing but the pigsty. The father is prepared, God himself is prepared to take the cost. As Jesus, God the Son, telling this story, the third son, if you like, in this story, is prepared to take the cost of forgiveness by going right to an agonizing death on the cross. All the sin of everyone who will ever trust in him condensed into 3 agonizing hours of agonizing death, a death that coined the word excruciating. A mind-blowing cost. God's outrageous love for rebellious rejection. The son remembers his father's goodness. He recognizes his own wrongdoing. He returns to his father, and his father restores him as his son. And again, step out of the story for a second. How are those 2 groups of people that are around Jesus feeling now? The tax collectors and the sinners. But this is amazing. Is this too wonderful? Would God really have me back like that? And the Pharisees, well, they're not happy. Sorry, Jesus, first of all, you've been welcoming these guys, and now you're saying God welcomes them as well? No, no way. But Jesus isn't done yet. The story's not finished yet, because this is a story about a father and 2 sons. And so now we're going to hear about the respectable rejection of the older son. Verse 25, meanwhile, the elder son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied. "Your father's killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." So remember, this older son, he's the son who didn't leave. He's the son who has been working away on the father's farm dutifully every day, and he comes in from a hard day's work, and it seems he's not yet heard what's happened. Now, he draws near the house, and he hears the party, and I think it's amazing. Notice, Jesus didn't just say he heard music. He heard music and dancing. How many people do you think it takes in a room for somebody who's coming from outside the house to hear the sound of them dancing? This is an almighty party, you might say. This is a huge party. And so he calls, "Son, one of the servants, what's going on?" You can imagine the servant comes out kind of, you know, enjoying the party himself, smile on his face, "Your brother's come home." And then the servant's face falls. Verse 28, the elder brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." Why is he angry? Who is he angry with? He's not angry first with his brother, is he? He's angry with his dad. And he has got everything that the younger son, that his younger brother did, as he remembered his father's goodness, recognized his own wrongdoing, and returned to his father, the older son gets completely backwards. First of all, he completely forgets his father's goodness. He's the son who didn't leave, remember? And how does he describe himself? "All these years I have been slaving for you." The point is, as a slave, you're not a slave according to your own volition, are you? You're a slave against your will. "And I've never disobeyed your orders." How does this older son think that he gets favor in the eyes of his dad? By obeying him. By being a good and dutiful worker. Actually, in his eyes, in this older son's eyes, his dad isn't a dad. His dad is a slave master. He has forgotten his father's goodness. And then he fails to see his own wrongdoing. He fails to see his wrongdoing, whereas his brother recognized his own wrongdoing. Do you hear how he says it? "This son of yours." Not "this brother of mine," "this son of yours," implying, do you know what? Actually, it's probably your fault that he ended up like this. I mean, after all that he's done, gone away and squandered your property with prostitutes, which, by the way, we don't actually know is true from the story, do we? But the older son seems to have no problem at all imagining that that's probably what the younger son was doing. Has squandered all your property. Look at accepting him back. No wonder he ended up like this. It's your fault. You should be kicking him back to the pigsty like he deserves. And I don't get what I deserve. A young goat to celebrate with my friends. Whilst he doesn't get what he deserves. A good kicking back to the pigsty. And so the older son doesn't see that he has the same problem as his brother. He wants all of his father's stuff without having a relationship with him as father. His way of thinking is that his dad is a difficult guy to please. But if I work really hard, then I'll please him and then he'll give me stuff, a young goat to celebrate with my friends. But actually, he is just as far from home as his brother ever was. And of course, the irony is, where is his brother right now? His brother is inside. And he is outside, standing, refusing to come in, and he cannot see his need for mercy. And actually, that need for mercy is from the older son is the key to understanding this parable, because it is not one lost son, it is two. There is one son who is lost in his brazen, irreligious rejection of the father. And then there is the second son who is just as lost in his respectable, religious rejection of the same father. Because the point about religion is that religion is all about what I do for God. But Christianity and this message that Jesus is giving is all about what God does for me in Jesus. And actually, do you know, you might wonder, how do I know if I'm an older brother or a younger brother? Well, you might know when you have tendencies of an older brother when you react in this kind of a way when a younger brother comes home. This is brought home to me really deeply a few years ago because I was quite literally an older brother. My younger brother had grown up in the same house as me, had heard the same good news of Jesus as me. I had never done the sort of outright rebellion thing, a bit of intellectual rebellion and rejection, thinking my parents were stupid, until the Lord very graciously worked in my life. My younger brother, he did the rebellion thing, well and truly, lived the lad life, all the way through kind of his late teens, all the way into university, until he then went on a gap year to Australia, and the Lord grabbed hold of him and brought him back. And after that gap year, after years of really struggling in a relationship with my dad, my younger brother with my dad, because of everything that had happened, he just walked straight back into my family, as if nothing had happened, restored. And do you know how I felt? Cross. Here he is, just wandered back in as if nothing has happened. Here I am, I've been dutifully a good boy, and my parents are just showering him with favor. And all the while, my heart was just like this older brother, thinking that I needed to work to get my parents' favor, and that was only really a reflection of the way that I saw God. How do you respond? You may be serving all manner of ways in church. You could be a house group leader. You could be a children's group leader. You could be preparing yourself to devote yourself, giving time and energy this week to the children in Holiday Club. And all the while, you could be doing it so that you might maybe get a young goat to share with your friends. And so the third thing, the older son gets backwards where his younger brother had returned to his father. The older brother refuses to go in. And do you notice, he wants a young goat. There's a fatted calf in there that's just been killed. He can't see what is right in front of him. And so the father comes out again in outrageous love. And here's the final thing, the final chunk. The father is ready. Just look what he does. The elder brother became angry, verse 28, refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. Not an issuer of commands, like the brother thinks, but pleading with his brother. He answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you, never disobeyed your orders, yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends." Verse 31, "My son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Imagine that servant coming back into the party, looking worried. There's all the huge party going on. He looks worried. He comes up to the father, to the landowner, the guy who's hosting this party. Neighbors and relatives, as far as you can see, crammed into the room. Enough noisy dancing that the brother can hear it outside in the fields. And the father's like, "Why are you looking worried? What's wrong?" "It's your son. He won't come home." "What are you talking about? He's right here. He's come home. That's why this party's here." "No, not him. The other one. His older brother. He won't come home." Music stops. And right in view of all of his friends and all of his relatives, the father walks out to go and plead with his son. once again prepared to take the cost that moving towards his son in forgiveness will cost, ready to absorb it. And what does he call him? My son. Do you see? Where the younger son are asked to become a servant, the older son is saying that he is a slave, and the father's response to both is exactly the same. You're not my servant, you're not my slave, you're my son. This is the same dad who ran to meet his younger son. The same dad who restored his younger son. And now he's saying, come in. Please come in. And that is the point of this parable. Jesus says, this is what God is like, and a God of outrageous, costly, generous love, who longs to have us as sons and daughters, not rebellious runaways and not respectable, resentful slaves, but sons and daughters experiencing this love. So let's pause one more time. Two groups of people listening to this story. Tax collectors and sinners gathering round Jesus, Pharisees standing at a distance and muttering. And where are you? Where are we? Are you with the tax collectors and the sinners, with the younger son? I'm free, but in the end, it will all end up in the pigsty. You're invited in by this father, restored by this father, if you would come to him, if you would recognize your own wrongdoing and return to him. Or are you with the Pharisees, the older son, working hard, maybe looking great in church life, leading in all sorts of different ways, but actually deep down rejecting the goodness of your father in your heart, wanting his stuff, wanting his stuff as you work hard to get his favor? Because did you notice how the story ends? It doesn't. Jesus doesn't finish the story. And so he appeals to the older brothers. He appeals even to the Pharisees as they stand off aloof muttering, will you write the ending of this story? Will you come in and receive the forgiveness of this outrageously loving father, whether you are rebellious or respectable in your rejection of him? Let's pray, shall we? Father in heaven, it's difficult to know what even to pray in the light of this outrageous love that the Lord Jesus demonstrates to us, that you show to us, even as Jesus tells us this parable on his way to the cross. Father, please help us not to be those who would stand aloof and muttering at this forgiveness. Help us to be those who would receive it, accept it, and rejoice in it. Amen.